When Julian Zugasagoitia first came to the Nelson-Atkins in 2010, it was for a dinner in his honor. He'd just been hired as the CEO and director of the museum, but he was still an out-of-towner. As a New Yorker, he was accustomed to walking everywhere, so he walked right up to the museum door to find that it was locked. Everyone else was coming in through the garage by car. Which is to say, Julian arrived as an outsider, who's quickly become a known personality, running one of the city's most prized civic institutions. But that outsider's perspective has been the key in some ways to his success in opening up the museum to the whole community. After all, he knows what it's like to be a first-time visitor, someone so lost they can't find the door. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and today's show is a portrait session with Julian Zugasagoitia. Hi, Julian. I'm so happy you're here.
Oh, delighted to be here.
So, I mean, at this point, is it hard for you to remember those first impressions now that this is a place you go to work every day?
You know, it is interesting. I'm going to be starting my 8th year, and in a way, it's a perfect spot of feeling that I know both the institution. I've been so gratified and welcomed by this community. And there's still some freshness, I hope. But it is important to retain that and those first early impressions, and still working on some of them. But yeah, it's still, today it feels more like home than anything else.
What were some of the first impressions other than the door is hard to find?
So the impressions that we're still working and operating on. So, and having early conversations as I came a few times before for the interviews and things like that, I would ask whether the taxi that picked me up at the airport, if they had been to the Nelson or if they knew what is there to be seen in the city. And often, very quickly, very immediately, people raved about the Nelson. And there was this notion of it is our jewel in town. And then I would follow up with a question, oh, what is there, or when was last time you went there? And sometimes the surprise was that they had this affection or this reverence for the institution, but they had not visited in many, many years, or they were not aware that it was free, or there were so many elements that still put a distance. And sometimes I assimilate that to the people would say, oh, yes, but last time I was there is when we had friends visiting from out of town a couple of years. Oh, no, they came 5 years ago. So it was like distant, and it was for special occasions. And so that remains one of the things that early on illuminated what we were trying to do in saying, well, it should be for everyday consumption. It should be something that the museum should be everybody's lives, and that you can come on your own terms for 5 minutes or for a whole day. We're free, so it's easy to come in and out once you know where the doors are. But you see, so it was also all of those realizations. And then definitely the doors, after a few years, I was walking with a person that was helping us think about also graphic design and wayfinding. And one of the doors that is close to Noguchi Court that leads you to the sculpture park is actually all frosted. By then, I was so familiar with that door, I was not looking that the fact that it was frosted is an impediment. And now, out of just that conversation, that someone's like, but it's frosted, it's not inviting, it's not transparent. And so now we use that door to put super graphics, and very soon that activates very well the museum.
Do you think that issue of people not seeing the Nelson is someplace that you just go when you have a free half hour or something like that? Is that a struggle for all museums, or is there something particular about the way Kansas City relates to this institution?
Well, there's very positive sides to that kind of reverence that people have for the museum. You know, there is an understanding that it's incredible art, that it has an amazing quality, the excellence for which the institution. But I think many institutions share with us that people, once they have committed time, and time is the most difficult thing to have today. They have committed time to go into an institution. They want sometimes to see it all, or they say, okay, now that we came, let's spend time. The fact that we're free takes away that barrier, because you could come in and out see one gallery. But I also like to stress that if you go for the first time to a restaurant, you don't order all the menu. You pick and choose. And so I'm trying to, because we're open and free, to suggest to our visitors, well, there's many ways of visiting. If it's your first time, maybe you want to rush through everything and see what you like best. If you are a frequent, or if you live in Kansas City and can come, well, pick and choose a gallery. Don't just spend some quality time in one or two galleries or three, or make a pause, go to Roselle Court, grab a sandwich. And so that it is not something that feels that you have to do all the galleries every time you come, because then that is overwhelming. It's just like ordering the entire menu at a restaurant.
Have you ever done a quick rush through the whole place? Like you were just saying, that's one option. I was thinking about when you were saying that there's a French movie with a scene that's an uncut run through the Louvre in Paris.
Yes.
And I've never done that at a museum, but it looks really, really fun.
Well, that was something, because I studied my art history at the École du Louvre. That is something that we all had in mind, and we all tried to break that record, actually, from the film. So
Band of Outsiders is the movie.
Exactly. And I've done it at the Louvre, and of course I've done it also at the Nelson. And I do it...
How fast did you do it?
Well, I should look again at my times and see if I can keep my scores coming down. But it is... Actually, when I go for the first time to a museum that I don't know, I do try to walk very quickly just to get sense of how it's organized, if there's anything that really speaks to me and stops me on my tracks.
So you're like making a table of contents?
Exactly. Seeing it all and then deciding what I really want to focus on. You know, so and that is when I just don't know the institution, or it's the first time, or they've just gone through a big expansion or reinstallation of the... But it is also because... What I would say, that gives me a quick sense of everything, and then I would focus on something.
You were coming from New York, as I mentioned. You had worked at the Museo del Barrio. Mm-hmm. Forgive my accent. But tell me about that place and its role in New York City.
So just to give a bit of context, so my professional development, first, before coming to New York, I was in Paris, and in Paris I was working first for UNESCO and then for the Getty Conservation Institute. So the Getty out of Los Angeles, but I was still based in Paris. So when the Getty opened and their beautiful center in Los Angeles, and I was working there, and the idea was perhaps to relocate to LA, but my wife and I had just gone a few months before that opening to the opening of the Guggenheim Bilbao by Frank Gehry. And literally, we were blown away. And we were blown away because the sense of what architecture can do also to transform a city.
Right. That had been an old fishing village that became kind of like a magnet for arts people from all over the world.
Exactly. And I think that was very deliberate by the Basque government, and to create. So it was from a fishing history also then to industrial. So it's a very industrial city. And then it had been in decay in the second part of the 20th century. And they really made a commitment to bring the arts as an energizer. And so, and perhaps of the many investments they did in culture, the Frank Gehry building and the Guggenheim Alliance created something that was very novel at 1997, at the end of the 20th century. And I think also it galvanized what architecture could be for the general mass. I think there had been some incredible pieces of architecture, but that moment galvanized people's mind. And again, it's one of the great masterpieces of end of the 20th century, or perhaps we can imagine that as the first piece of the 21st century, Frank Gehry's Bilbao. But it also worked as a great museum. It brought contemporary art to a place in Europe that perhaps had not had that kind of attention. And so it really galvanized, and it galvanized my own imagination of what my professional career could be.
How so? What had you imagined before, and what was new about
so
that?
So I had a very classic training, even if I had modern contemporary art in my background. But one of also my areas of concentration had been Egyptology. So really the whole gamut, and medieval art is something I also very much liked. So it had been really a very vast spectrum. And given that a lot of my work at that time also had to do with cultural patrimony and cultural heritage, and then working conservation with the Getty Conservation Institute, it was going in many directions. And it was just curating a couple of shows, one that had to do with Egyptian art and then some more contemporary, that started defining also my curatorial ambitions or perspectives. But at that particular moment, when the two great institutions open significant transformative buildings, whether the Getty that had a whole campus with, and again, it's a masterpiece in L.A., and there is where I felt that my personal excitement about modern and contemporary art, and also the juncture of a very daring architecture, was something that was galvanizing, to the point that at one of those dinners that of the opening of the Getty Center, I started a conversation with both Tom Krenz and Lisa Dennison of the Guggenheim about working with them. And it was just very, very symbiotic almost. After a year, I literally didn't relocate to LA, relocated to New York, and then worked there for 4 or 5 years before going to Museo del Barrio. But the reason I was bringing this up is because I arrived to New York as a Mexican coming from Paris, educated in Europe. So it's a bunch of things. And all of a sudden, New York, I feel that having a very mixed baggage heritage is what everyone else has. And so it feels
it's just so normal.
So comfortable. Yes. And so even our kids who have, my wife is being French, my being Mexican, in the schools, everyone has dual or triple kind of identities, you know, to the point that a good friend of my son early on, he was the exception almost, and he was American-American. And we called him like that, Texan, New Jersey parents, you know. Everyone else was like Indian-American or French-Mexican, you know, so all these combinations. And the exception was almost someone with dual heritage from the U.S. And so that was very rich and very a perspective that was. And so when Museo del Barrio invited me to join, it was the first opportunity I had professionally and my own history and my own trajectory to bring two things together, my search of my own identity and my own voice.
Professionally?
No, on a personal basis almost, you know. And as someone that, of course, values my Latino heritage, but in a way of saying, well, what does it mean in the United States today to be a Latina, and what it is, the identity that has been shaped? And
can you talk a little bit more about how you were wrestling with that personally?
So what I would say is, like, you know, when you're born somewhere, as I was born in Mexico, I was very early aware that the heritage, I was born in Mexico because of the Second World War, because of Nazism, because of the Civil War in Spain. So the two sides of the family each had endured terrible things, which by virtue of immigration, by virtue of displacement, these two families, Jewish Germans from one side and Spanish Civil War from another, transit through Paris before it is occupied by the Nazis. And then they flee to Mexico, two different families. And then the result of that is me being born and my sister in Mexico. And so you're born, and my family does give us the notion of how Mexico has been a welcoming country to us, just like America has been for so many other generations. And so you have a deep respect, but so I feel deeply Mexican. And at the same time, that is not something that you internalize, especially not growing up. You're just there.
You know? Well, you know, it's interesting because you talk about about Mexico being welcoming to you, mm-hmm. but that's an interesting way of talking about a place where you were born, like that you're from there, but also see yourself as someone who needs to be welcomed.
Well, yes, and it is that sense, because there's always that gratitude that you're able to be alive, and you're able to be alive in a country and a context that allows you to be there. because it was that welcoming part to the generation of your parents.
I mean, tell me a little bit more about your family's flight from Europe.
Mm-hmm. Well, so it is my father, who was a child, whose father, so my grandfather, they had to escape from the civil war in Spain. My grandfather had been actively fighting against Franco's regime to the point that they escape, they go to France. At that point, also, my grandfather was a journalist and a writer, and so he writes the memories of the civil war, which even today apparently are considered among the important and non-partisans, even if he was really on one side of the equation, but at least a good.
And, but wait, was his work then controversial in some way?
No, he wanted to be objective, and he wanted to be, he wanted to tell the story, and that book remains today an important book for the understanding of the Civil War. But he was an actor also of the Civil War, both as a ministry during some government of Negrín. The fact that he was an actor positions him in a special way, but also the fact that he's still considered as an intellectual, someone that was very balanced and everything, gives even more poignant things to the fact that he was killed by Franco eventually, a few years after he was captured by the Gestapo in France and then sent to Spain, and Franco's regime killed him. Again, because he had witnessed a lot. Thank God he had already written everything. And today it's a memory. But imagine for the family of my father, they have then to leave France, which was a safe haven for a moment, and then the first boat at that time was coming no longer to the U.S. The U.S. had closed its borders, but then went to Mexico. And many, many of the refugees of the Civil War of Spain who happened to be in Mexico or other countries of Latin America became also the intellectuals and the stimulant force of a renaissance on our countries of stimulus, intellectual stimulus. There were teachers, there were intellectuals, there were artists, there were businessmen. And so all of this influx really changes also the nature of a country. So that's the Spanish side. And my grandmother, so my mom is already born in Mexico, but my grandmother, a little bit similar story, escapes Germany, is in Paris, and she was an actress already.
And your family in Germany, that's a Jewish-German family.
Jewish-German family from Berlin. And so she escapes. And she is in Paris in her 20s, meets my grandfather, another German refugee there, and start a family. And that's when the Gestapo then also enters France. So my grandfather, from my mother's side, he enlists in to serve the Légion Étrangère and fights the Second World War, while my grandmother also tries to escape from occupied France to liberated France, and then the first boat goes to Mexico. And, you know, those times, some boats would come to Ellis Island, some others, you just jump in the first boat. And so my uncle was born in Paris, then my mom and her twin in Mexico. But there's always, and I only get to know my maternal grandmother, so that is my connection to this history. And in that sense, also, she articulates some of her greatest years in Paris, and that's perhaps the reason also my father had great memories of a few moments in Paris. So Paris was a very important thing for both families before it became a place that you had to leave again. So that's why also perhaps I ended up in a French school in Mexico, the equivalent of l'Académie Lafayette here, and then went to do my studies in France. There's a fascination for France.
Do you think that your upbringing as part of a refugee family in Mexico, did that shape your sense of yourself and your place in the world?
You know, it did. And what I was saying earlier, you're conscious to a certain degree of that. At the beginning, growing up, perhaps not. But all of those things become more into focus in adolescence. And then also the choices I made at one point or another, like going to do my last year of high school to France and things like that, shaped and were catalysts to understand who I was. So it was really upon leaving I lived when I was 12 also in England, or the UK, in Cardiff to be precise. And that is the first time I've been called names. I was a foreigner. I was also actually in a little school first to learn English with a lot of people from all over the world. And you sense the tensions, the racial tensions, the discrimination and things. I mean,
directed at you?
To me and all of the others. And sometimes at me specifically as the Mexican, which it was interesting. You know, it was like, oh, yeah, I'm Mexican. And I've always been proud of saying it. And, you know, but all of a sudden there it turned interesting. And so going to France, and then when I was close to, when I started working in France, a little bit of UNESCO and then other places, what was interesting is there I became a Latin American. Because a lot of friends were Latin American. A lot of friends. Also, there was...
Just a change in terminology?
Well, like, it was more encompassing. It was creating a world of the people that were a little bit like me and with the same passions. And literature was a great passion of mine and continues to be. So
you went from being Mexican to being Latin American.
Exactly. And it was a way of connecting to a group of people, whether they were artists, writers, and there was a construct of that identity. And identity is always a construct, you know, whatever one's identity, it is these questions. And so there, what I learned is like Latin America was such a vast country with different histories, with different subtleties. But what brought us together was much more common than what was subtleties. But the joy was in talking to a Cuban friend or an Argentinian friend, then the joy of listening to words that were different or expressions that were so authentic to each of us, that meant, or sometimes even different things. And then there was a camaraderie of understanding each other and then in the joys of those differences. And that was, and you feel also you're part of a larger community all of a sudden, and in which, again, as I said earlier, the what you have in common is so strong that the differences that you have, you celebrate them rather than antagonize them.
We'll pick right back up with Julian Zugasagoitia after the break. Coming up, we'll hear about his upbringing in Mexico as part of a refugee family from Europe. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with us. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and today's show is a portrait session. I'm talking to Julian Zugasagoitia, the director of the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art, about his upbringing in Mexico and his identity as part of a refugee family in Mexico. But then also, we were just discussing that when you started work as the director of the Museo del Barrio in New York, that was partly your quest to find your voice through all this history that we've just been talking about. What emerged? I mean, talk to me about where you were personally in that moment and what that new position with a museum that showed Mexican art and Latin American art, what that meant to you.
So, you know, it was understanding what Latinos or Latin Americans and what this time of America is. And I thought, what an opportunity to see this from the vantage point of view of an institution, the Museo del Barrio, that actually was founded by the Puerto Rican community of New York. And
I should say there were protests when you started because you were the first non-Puerto Rican director.
Correct. And it was, and it continues to be a very important platform for Puerto Rico. And I knew that I was entering a territory that yet also was going to allow me to find my own voice, but also to expand the voice, perhaps, of that institution in doing so. And so it was the perfect time also to put my personal biography and my years of professional training and development and studies together. And so those protests that early on happened were so definitive also in what we're trying to do is say...
What was that like, though? I mean, to have people protesting your you in your new position?
So let me tell you the anecdote that really captures this. So I am, just like here, when I first came, I was not yet director and I can't find my way into the museum. There is a defining story also in New York. So I'm designated, but I have not been presented to the public, or there's, you know, and I think I began in November and this must have been October. And there is an opening of an exhibition called the ESFAS, that is a biennial of Latin American art and Latino art that the museum organized every 2 years. And so there's a lot of young artists and there's a lot of, and I said, well, I'm in New York, it's October, I'm going to be the director anyway, so I will want to welcome people and say a few words. And the chair of the board said, of course, great idea. So I go to the museum early to start preparing some remarks, see the show. And my assistant then comes and says, Julian, there's a lot of protesters and they're passing even things, a campaign that was called We're Watching You. There were a lot of tension because some community
like leaflets
organizers
that say We're Watching You, that kind
well,
of thing?
Well, the campaign was called We're Watching You campaign because what the community wanted is that the board would have given some community representatives the voice in selecting the next director. And the board, being a private institution that it is, selected a director that happened to be Mexican, and so the first one. So they didn't have a voice in that, and so they were contesting a lot of things. And so there was a moment of panic, and they said, maybe it's not a good idea that you go down and say a few words after all. And it's like, look, I'm going to be the director anyway. I'd rather start having those difficult conversations now or later and exposing my ideas and my voice in front of everyone. And so I went down, and no one had seen my face. So there was, I could mingle a little bit, also listen to some of the things. And someone gave me, there was like a little button with the We Watching You campaign that was like an eye with the iris, the flag of Puerto Rico. And they gave me the button, I put it inside my pocket of my jacket and went eventually to the podium. And one of the most difficult things for museum directors is to have an audience quiet down when you're starting remarks. That was the first time I had no problem. It was like...
like you showed up in silence.
And that was the scary moment. And, you know, sometimes the adrenaline is the best thing in those kind of circumstances. And, you know...
or the worst. But in this case, the best.
In this particular instance, the instincts and adrenaline work so well. Because I did depart from whatever I had prepared because I knew that it was not going to work. But I just said a very few words. And I said that I was the incoming director and that I was delighted that there were so many people. And then...
even though they were there to protest you.
Well, I gave them the benefit of the doubt. What was important, so... in saying a few remarks, and I said, look, and you're having you're watching your campaign, and it's great. And I pull out the button and I put it on myself and saying, it's great because the board of trustees have asked me to look after this institution too. So we have a similar mission. And then I said, but I'm also a person of words, and what I will be doing is listening to all of you. And which I did. And I don't do good in large groups. So I met with a lot of these community organizers and representatives one-on-one. And very quickly, what I heard was the passion that they had for the institution, the way they saw things. And they also saw that what I characterized is they felt that their Puerto Rican identity would be lost with the notion of a Mexican director. And I said, no, I think the roots of this organization are indeed Puerto Rican. Today, New York is also completely diversified in Latinos and Latin Americans. And if the roots of this institution grow and continue to cement, but also you branch out to the Caribbean people, the Mexican people, the Ecuadorians, I mean, the South American, because New York definitely is a melting pot of all of these nationalities. And I said, you strengthen the voice of also the Puerto Rican heritage. but also you give voices to all of the other voices, and together, and that is perhaps what I had learned in Paris of being a Latin American, it's that we have so much more in common. And that is what maybe we put forward, because a lot of our visitors that love art, because also we define that that is a place for people who loved art, not for Latinos only. So our goal was to have as many Latinos as non-Latinos come and visit and partake in our, in the beauty of the culture. And that started to happen. So those same people that were protesting when I came were the ones who were very sad to see me leave. And that I took as the best compliment I could have had from the job.
You know, you have had such an international life and career. You have often, it just strikes me, been positioned as an outsider wherever you have shown up, whether it's just because you're new or if it's because, you know, coming from a family of European Jews in Mexico, or being a Mexican in Paris, or being a Mexican director of what was originally conceived as a Puerto Rican museum in New York. And now, as this New Yorker who's used to walking everywhere, showing up in Kansas City, is that kind of a defining part of who you are?
You know, and I think that is the excitement that nourishes me. It's being in that and recognizing that situation that is always a bit uncomfortable, but on the other side, enriching. And I want always to be in those situations in which I have more to learn, and entering a new context, or coming to the Midwest definitely was, as I sometimes describe it jokingly, having lived in many, many countries, this is as foreign country as I've ever been.
Can you explain that a little more? What seemed so foreign about it at first, or maybe still does now?
Well, one of the things that still surprised me is that there's, even in the greatest metropolitan area, only 2 million inhabitants. You know, I was born in a city that I think now has like 30 million or 40. I left Mexico City because I hated the traffic. I hated driving, and then went to Paris. And I felt it was a small city with 8 million people, or 5 or 7 at the time. And now New York, still definitely bigger than Paris, but they felt smaller than my original Mexico City. So coming here definitely feels like a smaller, and it has virtues that I didn't know existed. You know, there's a notion that I had heard, read about it, and a lot of people talked about the virtues of the quality of life. And in many of the cities I've lived, that doesn't exist. And I've discovered it only now in Kansas City. Kansas City has the perfect size for an amazing, especially in the things we like, the cultural offering is just so rich and varied in all forms. There are different perspectives. And on the other side, everything is so conveniently located. So you're not struggling, you know, so it is. And I know I'm contradicting myself when I said I would love 2 or 3 more million people, because then we have a bit more traffic and more inconvenience and the parking would be more difficult. Nevertheless, the quality of life that we experience in today is amazing.
We've got to take one more break in our portrait session with Julian Zugasagoitia, the director of the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. And we haven't even talked about the fact that his mom was an actress who starred in Mexican telenovelas. More on that in a minute on KCUR's Central Standard. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman talking to Julian Zugasagoitia about his international life and career. I want to back up, like, maybe to the very beginning, to your childhood in Mexico, and just get more of a feel for what that was like. I mean, something that I happen to have heard about you is that you have come from a family of artists. Your grandmother, I believe, was a television producer who produced Mexico's first telenovela.
Yes.
Tell me about her.
Oh, she was a force of nature. And, well, imagine she was this young woman that had to escape first Germany, starts her career as an actress in Paris, then has to escape from Paris, comes to Mexico. She was widowed very young because my grandfather went to Mexico after serving at the Légion étrangère, but goes to Mexico.
And that's part of the resistance in World War II?
Exactly. And then they had the twins that my mom and her brother Roberto are. But he passed away when my mom was 8. So this woman had to come to subsist the 3 children that she has, and does everything. So the television is one of the things, but she was also translating for any symposium that there could be. So she had like different personalities just to subsist and bring this family. So there's that sense also that is today in retrospect, the values that I see in people who immigrate, people who are forced out. There's a survivor instinct that makes them busy, try to bring so much to every culture that they live in. So my grandmother was that. And early on then, because she had been an actress, she's trying to act a little bit. Someone is starting a new TV station. So this is the beginning of television. And she, I'm sure, said, yes, I've done this before, or improvised herself. I don't know. She was such a...
like a fake it till you make it type thing?
Well, but because if there's never been TV, there's no one who has ever produced TV. And so, you know, so, but she had done a bit of theater, so it must be a little bit like that. And so I'm sure it is a bit like that. It's, you know, when self-made people are that way. And so she starts, and she was then one of the pioneers of Mexican television.
And your mother is an actress.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes by Susanna Alexander, but yes, has a much longer name, as Wikipedia tells me.
So it's Susanna Alexander Katz, that's the legal name, but she shortened it to Alexander only, and that's her maiden name, because she started, because of course now with my grandmother pioneering on Mexican TV, so my grandma, my mom, since she's 6, she's always in the studios and everything, so she was an actress since 6 or 7 years old, and became then, on her own rights, a very prominent actress, and till today.
What was it like to grow up with a mom who was like on the television screen? And I mean, did you get a chance to see her at work? Did she fill a particular kind of role?
So she was always the villain, and so that doesn't ingratiate yourself with the friends. When she was always on those soap operas early on, as I was growing up, always the counter to the whatever main female actress, she was the bad one. And so that gave an edge. But I do remember, I mean, there's two sides of this. One, those are my parents. So a lot of these things I've never questioned. So my father was a mathematician and passionate of literature and philosophy, which influenced me a lot. But you think that all families are exactly like yours because you never question that. You never question what the other parents do. And so
right, this
it
is
seems
what a
natural.
Mom is. This yeah. is what a dad is.
It seems natural. And it's only later that you start thinking. And so the funny thing is when, for instance, I used to go when I was little to the studios also, and when she was filming, and sometimes I appeared in some things just because you're there, you know. Or also I remember the first time I walked in front of a live camera. So when they're taping, not taping, but when it's live, and I had maybe gone more to studios that were not live, that were taping soap operas.
But wait, how old do you think you are at this point?
6, 7, 8, something
like
that.
So like how much you've gone to what kind of TV studio is part of your existence?
It's part of like, it's summer and there's no school, then your mom takes you there. And I liked, what I liked is the behind the scenes. I like the technology. I started, but I remember being vilified because I crossed paths in front of a live camera and like, who's that kid? Like, so then my mom also got grounded, I guess. But so those are memories. But the perhaps the most difficult memory, and it was like, I must have been around 7. I was watching the soap opera where my mom playing in my house, and my mom is not at home, and she dies. So
your even, mom's character died on screen.
On screen. And even if I had gone to the stage, I mean, at 6 or 7, you don't understand, and you think she died. And so I was inconsolable, apparently. And then eventually my mom comes, and I just have like, what is going on? But that day, everything was explained to me. Santa Claus doesn't exist. Superman doesn't fly. A lot of this
Let's
is
just get TV. It all out on the table.
And so I got a very clear reality check at that moment, which also I think deeply that has a lot of how I see also life between fiction and reality. And I know very well that representation is one thing and the reality is completely different.
When did you start getting interested in visual art?
That was more later in adolescence. And with a group of friends, we would go to museums. And I remember a summer that my mom had been invited by Joseph Papp to go to his festival.
And who is that?
Joseph Papp. Oh, he's an amazing figure he was an amazing figure in New York. He was, among other things, and I think the most well remembered by being the creator of the Public Theater, which brings free Shakespeare in the Park. So that he had various festivals, among which one at the Public Theater that I think was for Latin American art and something like that. And my mom was performing there. He's also the producer of the Coors Line and a bunch of things. I mean, he was one of those incredible figures. And so we had just come from living in the UK, and my mom was doing this one-woman show that she performed also at the Edinburgh Festival and things like that. And I wanted to go to New York, and now I speak English. You know, this is when we come back from. And so New York was always a place that I was fascinated by. And my mom's best friend that had an apartment in New York and was welcoming us and everything. So I come with her, and then I stay for a whole month. And that month is when I started going by myself after she left to museums and discovering what it is to be a bit autonomous. And it was just an amazing summer. And that is when I discovered the cloisters, and my passion for perhaps medieval art comes from that visit.
It's a campus of the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And it overlooks the river.
The Hudson River. It's just a poetic space. It's on Washington Heights.
And so you went to these museums by yourself?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I had a whole summer, I'm going to say there a month or something. And so that is the things you did. And because I was, I think, visiting by myself, I started just finding what I liked, what I didn't like, what talked to me, what didn't talk to me, and then trying to make things up. So that is when I really started looking at a room and say, why does it make sense? Why are they hanging all these paintings? So I think that is also when I started thinking more like I do today. You know, it's just like the instincts of just trying to understand what was going on in a room.
Would you think you were captivated more by art or by the experience of museums?
You know, I think there's two things. One, I would say I was really captivated by the fact that it was a very hot summer and these places were air conditioned. So that, and they were cheap. And so I think that has a lot to do with my accessing these places. And there's a feeling for me at the time in which, you know, my parents have told me, it's going to be so dangerous, or be careful. Even my mother's friend says, like, be careful. So there was sort of like, this is the 80s and still like grim New York, and they're so afraid. So museums seemed like a safe haven. If I told them, I will be spending the day at the museum, they didn't worry. And so all of a sudden, it becomes my geography. I know where all these museums are situated, and I start liking going back, and it feels like a safe place, and I can spend hours on end. And so that is the feeling I have from the memories of the time. Is like, I feel, I can navigate these places.
You went, the first place you named is the cloisters, and that's like a reconstructed monastic garden, right?
Correct. It is a former cloister that they brought from France. I think the Rockefellers helped for that transfer.
Which was literally built then as a safe place. I mean, that's what a cloister is.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. Yes. Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm asking about whether it's the art or the museum experience, because I think there is something particular about being in a museum that is not just about the art. It's a feeling, like, I think there are probably some religious people who get a certain feeling in a religious institution, like a church or a temple or whatever. There's a kind of feeling in a museum that is special that I don't know how to describe, but I wonder if you can describe what it is to you.
So I think for me, definitely, and the cloister in particular, the experience is overwhelming because it's a historic building from the 14th century, translated to New York. You're overlooking the Hudson River. There's gardens that smell beautifully. So there, yes. But I would say that every museum experience, what I what it is for me, it's first of all, it's peaceful, generally. Then the second thing is that you are attuned to your senses. And that is what it's more enjoyable. When you're starting to look at art, when you're starting to just let yourself be inspired by that and looking at colors or looking at the depiction of a skin tone or what they can feel, all of a sudden your level of empathy with that work of art and just you're letting yourself go to enjoy sensually. I would say for me, museums is a very hedonistic sensual experience. You're enjoying just seeing. And so that, and a sense of quiet, a sense of peace, and then a sense of reflection of who you are in front of that piece of art.
That's funny because, yeah, I think different people look for different things in a museum experience. And I think I approach it pretty similarly to how you do. But I think there are also people who go in search of information. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I think those things can sometimes be at odds. Like the person who wants to just go and be in a sensory kind of experience and be transported by colors or shapes or mm-hmm. or whatever it is that's before them and their own dialogue with it, and people who would like to go and find out more about this movement in art history. And you know what I'm saying? Like that there's people have a lot of different needs in these spaces.
And I think there's no one way that is right or wrong to go to a museum. I think it is definitely a very individual quest. And I think also, even for each of us, you never go the same way to the same museum, you know, because first time maybe it's just to get acquainted, and other times you're looking for other things. So I think it's a very individual, and the notion of some people go for information, some people want to have the experience or the sense that they're getting something out of it. And that's why we're very careful about how much information and what we put on wall labels or text labels, or what is the information that can be easily consumed that gives you keys into a whole room, gives you keys into a display or an individual work of art. But if we do our work well, what we want to is instill a bit of curiosity and always leaving you wanting for more, because it is individual curiosity. And again, from which perspective you might come is always unpredictable for us. But each one can get something and then get started in something else. But my recollection of the worst moments for me in going to museums was when actually I was a student at the Louvre, because part of the exams of the Louvre, and it is a great school because it is object-oriented and it is about looking at the real things. And many of the exams were about remembering all of the objects or where they were, or almost giving a blind tour. At that time, it was because I needed to retain so much information, and it was more the effort of acquiring all that and maintaining it in my mind for all the exams, that I went to the museum with no joy, with just the effort of retaining it, and we would grill friends, and you know, it became almost transactional. You have to, from a very distance, name five artists or all the paintings. So it became a game.
Who did that and what year?
Exactly. And so it took away from the real experience of the work, because it was just getting the exam or getting all the facts right. And for me, what helped me enormously through all of those years was also doing another course of philosophy at the Sorbonne, because then it was about trying to put all the ideas together. And, you know, when you also use that to decipher things, even if you don't know who the artist is, if you can start then saying, well, you can look at this and this, connoisseurship is built that way. But it reminds me, I saw a great documentary on the sommeliers, the test to become sommelier,
wine connoisseurs.
Wine connoisseur. And Doc Frost is at the very end of that documentary. But you see three or four young people trying to get, and they're tasting wines and they're quizzing each other and they're tasting their knowledge.
Most unfun wine drinking ever.
And the only thing, there's never an expression of joy. There's never an expression of, oh, it really tastes good. No, everything is analyzed. And so I think you need sometimes, if you want to be in the professional sommelier, or if you want to be, you need to go through that phase to recover then the pleasure. But for art, the great thing is if you're not meant to be a professional, you can enjoy it at so many different levels just by showing up.
Well, Julian Zugasagoitia, our time is up. It has been so wonderful talking to you today, though. Thank you so much for being here.
I hope this is only the first half.
I know. Isn't that crazy?
But time thank you. Flies. Thank you for having me.
This has been a portrait session with Julian Zugasagoitia, meaning this interview will be paired online with photographic portraits by the incomparable Paul Andrews. We'll have that ready for you at kcur.org by the end of the weekend. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Danielle Hogarty. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's a wrap. Have a great weekend, everyone.